at my prepared talk. Usually I have prepared and timed my talk to fit exactly into the correct amount of time, which in this case would be about 40 minutes in order to allow time for discussion. I have sort of timed it, and it's about an hour and a half long, so I want to keep some correction. When I saw the first version of the timetable, I was the first speaker in the morning. Now I'm in the afternoon, nearly after lunch, which is traditionally the snooze period. So I will not hold it against anyone, but I will be noting down your location in the room for later. There's another item in today's report in The Guardian. Germany to ban paintball after massacre. The German government is planning to ban paintball and laser shooting games in reaction to the recent school massacre in which 15 people died. I raise that only to say that there are solutions to conflict, and there are non-solutions to conflict, and I'll be trying to talk about constructive ways of relating to conflict and violence. And there are also items in the paper today, obviously, about Afghanistan, about basically the US war in Pakistan. The Pakistani government is doing it, causing the flight of about 500,000 people through atrocious actions, atrocities, and so on. But basically, the US government is doing it, and they're forcing the Pakistani government to do that. I'm going to say a little bit about Afghanistan because it's the main war that's involved in right now. When I first saw the title, Ending Conflict, I wondered about possibly talking about internal conflict. It's really good that I'm doing this talk because I finally got around to finding out what neurosis means. Because as I was selecting a slide, it means a buried inner conflict below the level of consciousness, but in which you know there's a problem and you haven't lost touch with reality. Well, I've learned something, anyway. Those of you who are asleep won't benefit from that information. And I thought maybe I could relate it, you know, internal conflict, activism, there's a whole bunch of things you could say. Could relate it to burnout, which I think is a fundamental issue, I think, for people who are trying to make a difference in the world, who are located here and many other places in the world. But I thought actually probably people would be expecting more deal with external conflicts, as represented by these MOD Action Men toys, which were launched yesterday. These toys are part of a wide range of strategies by the Ministry of Defense, including the setting up of what I have called the Arcades of Death, i.e. recruitment centers at which you can work on actual battlefield simulators of the kind that the Army used for training their recruits. You can just walk in off the street and use it and find out how good you are at shooting people and so on. They've got one in Dalston, they're going to roll them out all over the country. And there's Unarmed Forces Day, which is coming up on the 27th of June. Armed Forces Day on the 27th of June. And these things are not really about trying to shore up a fading public support for the military, because that is rock solid. When you look at the polls, and the Army has done a bunch of polls themselves, over 90% approval and respect in the British public for the Army. Not to do with that, it's to do with the war. But public support for the military isn't parallel like support for the war. That was 2007, 2008. I think this is the key information. If you're working on Afghanistan, if you're working on war issues right now, you need to know this information. This is what you're going to be able to reel off, which when I was doing a media interview yesterday, I failed to reel off because I hadn't memorized it. But I think this is basically what it comes down to, that overwhelmingly, people in Afghanistan are against the bombing, and they are for negotiation. Overwhelmingly, people of Redfield say there are problems in that same poll. So, to take a simplistic troops out song is not in accordance with the wishes of the Afghan people, and that's something that everyone who's in the Afghan movement has got to grapple with. However, to match this, I've cunningly moved the numbers from one side of the page to the other in order to stimulate learning. But I think this is the key information. What the Afghan people want and what the British people support is a negotiated solution. And in fact, you also find a majority against the surge that the US is carrying out right now in Britain and in Afghanistan. Majority people say we don't want more Western troops in there making the problem worse. I also thought, when I read that title, conflict, about intellectual conflict. Now, intellectual conflict is necessary, important, valuable, like Newton's revolution in science, which was valuable because it moved from descriptive breadth to explanatory depth, which is the move that you have to make if you want to do science, if you want something to be a science. Incidentally, in passing, Newton's revolutionary move caused consternation in scientific circles at the time because it was seen as basically anti-scientific. Even though he was making this move to explanatory depth, he was basically overturning decades of work at trying to remove supernatural forces from how humans saw the world, and he introduced this force at a distance thing, gravity. And basically, it was just blew up the attempt to make materialism the basis of science at the time. So it was very problematic, right? Intellectual conflict in the arts, absolutely crucial. If we didn't have intellectual conflict, we wouldn't have scientific progress, we wouldn't have cultural progress. So conflict is good. Conflict is important. Conflict is necessary. Our ideas about freedom and justice, which are the fundamental bedrocks of peace, have changed. Women's rights, gay rights, disability rights, animal rights. At the moment, there's big issues around climate rights, rights of people with learning disabilities. All sorts of things have been realized to be problems, which a while ago most people didn't realize that there was a problem there. And I think that happens because there's conflict, value conflict, intellectual conflict about things. And I think one can expect that to continue indefinitely. So even after, hopefully, capitalism is abolished, and patriarchy is abolished and so on, even after all the things that we see right now as major problems are dealt with to the extent that humans can, we'll probably keep on discovering new frontiers of freedom. And we'll discover them because people will make a fuss, people will cause trouble, and people will engage in conflict. That's all necessary and important in the world. Obviously, there's not just issues to do with bloody physical violence, there's also issues to do with structural violence. Is it right? Is it just? That those of us who are in this hall, probably pretty much all of us have got in our pockets more computing power than was used for the Apollo mission. But people in rural parts of the world and in urban parts of the world are getting by without such luxuries. Is that right, Jeff? No, it's not right, Jeff. And is it justifiable? I don't think it is. There are structural problems. There is what is called structural violence. People who've been to my talks before know that I try to avoid using text, but this sums up very nicely an insight into the way that the world is. And it's written by a British cabinet minister. In 1914. Does anyone know who this is? Churchill. Does anyone know what the next slide is going to show? Next slide is going to show that is the statement as in his secret cabinet paper. The red bit shows the bit that he left out when he published the cabinet paper in the world crisis after the First World War. So that's Winston Churchill. Serious statement, statesman, war, happy imperialist. Okay, I don't want to imply there's any real connection between Winston Churchill and the Neanderthal. When we're talking about war and conflict, trying to end conflict and war and so on, I think there's some bedrock stuff which I feel obliged to try to say as well as I can. Our picture of ourselves as a species is of primitively us being human hunters. Actually, the phrase is used, man hunters, but human hunters. And that's our picture of ourselves. This is basically a false picture. It's more accurate to say that during even the lifetime of our species, modern humans, for most of that period, we have been prey rather than predator. The first sign of artificially made fire. Anyone know when that was? How long ago? I think that's as good as guess anyone else in the room. 15,000 years ago. No time. 15,000 years. No time at all. Our species has been going on 1,000 years. Right. Most of our lifespan of species, we have been prey. And that actually has been the main conditioner of how we behave, how we react, how we deal with the world in very deep and important ways. Everything that I'm saying now is like about 0.5% of the stuff in this book, Blood Rights, by Barbara Ehrenreich. Barbara Ehrenreich being a feminist writer at large, socialist. And she wrote this book about the origins and history of the passions of war. I recommend it highly. I think if you're interested in religion or in war, I think this is the foundational text. There are, I think, now other books which are being written by paleoanthropologists, but as a writer, she was summarizing the field. In essence, to take 0.5% of the book, the passions of war are to do with the amazing phenomenon of war fever. Nations get swept away. When a country goes to war, that happens. There's this jingoistic thing, like swimmers into cleanness leaping. I think that's Robert Brooks. You know, there's millions of people turning out to wave you off the war and so on. And this is an investigation into why does that happen? Why is war a sacred activity? And just to take one tiny little bit of what's in the book, it turns out that part of our organizing as fundamental units originally, as human groups, was probably, and I'm putting it crudely here, that in order to protect the group, probably that women, mothers, and children, and aged people, when we moved around, and we've got all of these lions, we've got all of this stuff, which we have no defense against. Look around. Who here has really got what it takes to take down a lion? We don't. As a species, we don't have it. And for most of our lifetime as a species, we weren't doing it. Our way of defending ourselves and continuing the species was basically to put the young, well, this is a crude summary of one theory, to put the young men on the periphery as sacrifices. Their job is not to fight off the lion, their job is to die at the hand of the lion, and so that the rest of the group can make it. So the problem is just about primatologists studying primates now. We don't tend to think of primates being prey because human primatologists tend not to go out at night, which is when they get killed. But even now, when you go out at night, you find that the majority of the largest single cause of death in a lot of primate groups is predation. And for example, baboons, when they go into the savannah, fall into a defensive marching order with young men on the periphery. And this, it is suggested, is part of the sacrificial element of war and soldiery. When you look at the language of war, what you find invariably is it isn't about go out there and kill those tons. It is, we admire you for going to give your life for the nation. It's not really about massacring, it's about martyrdom. That is the language of war, because the suggestion is we are wired as a species to honour sacrifice. We can't really help that basic response, and that is part of the dynamics of the support for war. And I'm sure the quick-witted among you will have already thought, well, actually, that also goes for non-violent direct action. That also goes for civil disobedience. That's how come people who are using non-violence to try to change things for the better manage to evoke a response sometimes from the uncommitted and sometimes even from the opponent, because we're wired to honour sacrifice. And it brings out a response to that. That's a suggestion. If someone keeps count of how many tissues they use, that may add up to the percentages right at the beginning. So anyway, there's a lot more to say on that. But there is something here which, if it's correctly founded, speaks a lot to issues that were raised earlier in relation to gender and militarism. Another basic point. War is often taken as a natural outcome of our human nature because we're aggressive. I'm not saying only these two men are aggressive, but that is a common view, is that war happens because we're aggressive creatures. It is true that humans have an aggressive side to them. Pretty much everyone's got an aggressive side to them to some extent. What is not true is that war has any relation to personal aggressiveness. War depends on there being a whole bunch of people in the modern warfare, a whole bunch of people who are willing to train for war. When you march in a parade, you don't do it because you're angry. When you learn how to fire a rifle, you don't do it because you're in a rage. And when you do all the stuff in basic training, there's some part of it where you have to unleash that rage. But overwhelmingly, you have to learn skills, and crucially, you have to learn to obey. Obedience is the fundamental military virtue, not rage. It's got nothing to do with it. There's also, bottom picture there, a whole bunch of people who have to do the logistics. They have to make sure the meals are there. Otherwise, your army falls apart. War now is about logistics, and it's about manufacture. It's about a whole bunch of complex social activities which take place because, basically, to put it very clearly, people obey. If you go back to the Nazi era and how the Holocaust was carried out, what you find is that the critical role, really, is carried out by people like us, white-collar people. People who are willing to make the computers, organize the railways, to do the logistics, to do all of that white collar crime which made massacring people into an industry. People like us, probably no smarter, no stupider, maybe people who started out with values like us in this hall. But that obedience is where war and violence come from. It's got nothing to do with an aggressive streak in humanity. I personally am committed to non-violence. However, I have a difficulty with some people who only extract some things out of non-violence and who want to make non-violence into just a nice force. When you do that, I only worked this out yesterday actually, when you do that, when you take out nice, what you leave behind is the non-love aspect of non-violence. And there is an aspect of non-violence, or you work it out, there is an aspect of non-violence which is not about lovey-dovey, hand-wringing concern for somebody else who is killing, who is oppressing, who is committing atrocities. Look, there is an aspect, in my view, of one brand of non-violence, which is not about niceness. And I think that the kind of non-violence that I'm committed to, following in the tradition of people who have gone before, I think what I would like to commit to is revolutionary non-violence. Kind of non-violence which, if kind of people who are involved in it, they may not particularly like the language of it, but who, in the framework, are thinking in terms of something like combat, something like battle, something like being a non-violent soldier. That's the kind of thing that I'm drawn to personally. Gandhi described himself as a soldier, non-violent soldier. Interestingly, I pulled out some stuff that I had, which I wasn't going to mention, because I was kind of I had twins, when we're talking about gender and militarism. There's a whole bunch of times where Gandhi says, I would risk violence 1,000 times rather than risk the emasculation of a whole race. Talks about emasculation quite a lot, actually, that kind of thing. I have a whole bunch of questions, I'll just read one more. I have been repeating over and over again that he who cannot protect himself or his nearest and dearest or their honour by non-violently facing death may and ought to do so by violently dealing with the oppressor. He who can do neither of the two, non-violently resisting or violently resisting, is a burden. He has no business to be the head of a family. He must either hide himself or must rest content to live forever in a helplessness and be prepared to crawl like a worm. Non-violence has also been pretty gendered as well, and there's a whole thing about manliness in one strain of non-violence. The reason I put Gandhi's picture here, though, was for a different reason, which was to do with conflict, about Gandhi's willingness to engage in conflict. Well, one thing he once said was, all compromise is based on give and take, but there can be no give and take on fundamentals. Any compromise on mere fundamentals is a surrender. He wasn't very big on surrender. This is a particular hero of mine, actually, he's one of the Chicago Seven, who was one of the people on trial for conspiracy to cause riots and so on, in 1968. Dave Dallinger was a US pacifist who wrote a book called Revolution Nonviolence, which I'm holding in my hand here. And it's a phenomenally valuable book to my mind. One thing that he mentions in it is in his essay just after Martin Luther King was assassinated. He says, "It is senseless, of course, to think that there will be no casualties. If there are no casualties, then the battle is not joined." He's talking about non-violent struggle. "Either the demands are not far-reaching enough, or a misinterpretation of non-violence leads the protesters to call off the struggle too soon." And I subscribe to that entirely. The person who I regard as the foremost theoretician of non-violence, personally, Barbara Denning, she wrote a book called, there's a collection of her stuff, it's about print, which is called We Are All Part of One Another, which I also highly recommend. And she said something in relation to structural violence, and also to issues of violent struggle and non-violent struggle. In an essay called On Revolution and Equilibrium. I don't think I'm actually going to quote from her essay On Anger, but I think that's the single most important text for people committed or interested in non-violence myself. When one is confronted with what Russell Johnson accurately calls the violence of the status quo, conditions which are damaging, even murderous, to very many who must live within them, it is degrading for all to allow such conditions to persist. And if the individual who can find the courage to bring about change, see no way in which it can be done without employing violence on their part, a very much lesser violence, they feel, than the violence to which they will put an end, I do not feel that I, and she was one of North America's former pastors, I do not feel that I can judge them. The judgments I make are not judgments upon men and women, but upon the means open to us, upon the promise these means of action hold or withhold. The living question is, what are the best means for changing our lives, for really changing them? It is true enough that one of the chief difficulties those who believe in non-violence must face is how to recruit others to trust themselves to this way. My own conviction is that one can recruit to this form of battle only by setting the very boldest kind of example. Yet, the challenge to those who believe in non-violent struggle is to learn to be aggressive enough. Non-violence has for too long been connected in people's minds with the notion of passivity. I would substitute another word here and rename aggression self-assertion. On the left here is A.J. Woodsey, who went through a period as a member of the Socialist Workers Party of the United States, the Trotskyite, but then he returned to both pacifism and to different kinds of politics, and he one of the most influential pacifists of the post-war period. And he, on a piece of paper that I've lost, he wrote an essay called On Pacifism and Class War. Single most important piece of paper, I found it, okay. He said, again, talking about structural violence, in a world built on violence, one must be a revolutionary before one can be a pacifist. In such a world, a non-revolutionary pacifist is a contradiction in terms, a monstrosity. The basic fact is that the economic, social, political order in which we live was built up largely by violence, is now being extended by violence, and is maintained only by violence, as Churchill conceded. The foremost task, therefore, of the pacifist in connection with the class war is to denounce the violence on which the present system is based and all the evil, material and spiritual, this entails for the masses of people throughout the world, and to exhort all rulers, social, political, industrial life, all who occupy places of privilege, all who are the beneficiaries of the present state of things, to relinquish every attempt to hold on to wealth, position, and power by force, to give up the instruments of violence on which they annually spend billions of wealth produced by the sweat and anguish of the toilers. So long as we are not dealing honestly and adequately with this 90% of the problem, which is the violence of the oppressors and rulers, there is something ludicrous and perhaps hypocritical about our concern over the 10% of violence employed by the rebels against oppression. This is a crowd of white racist protesters confronting some civil rights workers. The civil rights movement, which is a iconic non-violent struggle for justice and peace, was not a nice struggle. It was a about conflict. Martin Luther King said, "We know from painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed." I think there's something I'd really like to read, even though it's very cold. Hi, Neil Crowley. This is also from Dave Ellinger's Revolution Nonviolence. This is a photo from Birmingham, Alabama, and this is a story from Birmingham, Alabama. "We're going to win our freedom," and this is the language of the time, a Negro leader said at a mass meeting in Birmingham last year, "and as we do it, we're going to set our white brothers free." Yes, amen, sisters too. A short while later, when the Negroes faced a barricade of police dogs, clubs, and fire hoses, they became spiritually intoxicated, as another leader described it. This was sensed by the police and firemen, and it began to have an effect on them. "I don't know what happened to me," this the leader. "I got up from my knees and said to the cops, 'We're not turning back. We haven't done anything wrong. All we want is our freedom. How do you feel doing these things?' The Negroes started advancing, and Bull Connor," police chief, "Bull Connor shouted, 'Turn on the water.' But the firemen did not respond. Again he gave the order, and nothing happened. Some observers claimed they saw firemen crying. Whatever happened, the Negroes went through the line. The next day, Bull Connor was reported by the press who said, 'I didn't want to mess their Sunday clothes, all these people from church.'" Until now, Dave Dunham is saying, "until now, this move of outgoing, empathetic nonviolence has been rarely achieved in this country. There was only part of the story in Birmingham, where in the end, a more cautious tokenism gripped the top leaders. But it is a clue to the potential power of nonviolence. Not nice nonviolence, but making conflict, coming into confrontation. Another part of the story of the civil rights movement is the way in which teenagers, some of these kids aren't even teenagers, teenagers were allowed to take part in their struggle. And it was when they came onto the scene that the movement managed to break through the limits that had been imposed by their fill the jail strategy. Because after a while, the cops realized how to solve the fill the jail strategy by having enough jails available in their surrounding area. And you couldn't paralyze the system because they knew how to distribute the protesters enough. And it wasn't until the next stage of escalation was to show the world white racist police beating up African-American children that the struggle managed to break through and decided to win further victory. Again, I personally, if I was a leader of a movement and someone came to me and said, "School kids, teenagers want to come out in the streets, they want to get beaten, they want to get jailed, maybe weeks, they want to get kept in these kind of conditions, are we going to allow it?" I would have a great hesitation. I have a 13-year-old son, my 14-year-old son. I have a really hard time saying 14-year-olds go out and join the struggle. It's not a very nice thing to do, to basically say, yes, go out there, get beaten, get bitten by dogs, get bones broken, get thrown in jail. That isn't about being nice. That is about a kind of generalship. And whether you agree with it or not, that's part of the history, that's part of the experience of nonviolence. This is my top pick for books about the rights of women. I haven't read a whole lot, but this is the one that I have learned the most from, about the grassroots movement and the movement that enabled people like King to be together. The grassroots movement created to a large extent by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I have run out of money. So I can't talk about something which I feel more and more passionately about, which is the relationship of class issues to all of the things that we're just discussing today. This is a picture from 1968, a factory taken over by the workers, as this bit. And that was an iconic time of student revolution and workers' revolution. I use the word revolution in a very loose term, but revolution movement being in sync. Another one we're about to mark when people go on and on about Tiananmen Square. They tend to go on and on about students and intellectuals, people like us. They don't really tend to go on about the workers and trade unions, who are also in that square, who also got killed in the press. I was going to say this for the end, but I'm starting now. Dave Dellinger again. Histories are written by intellectuals, people like us, who generally give undue credit to other intellectuals for making history. So histories are written by intellectuals. History is made by people who commit themselves, their lives, and their energies to the struggle, who may or may not be intellectuals. This is from the Vizion factory, which got occupied recently. I think corporate leaders are quite worried about what's happening right now. There were occupations in Belfast, Enfield, Basin Slope, I think, where the factories were taken over because people were unhappy about the way that they were being chucked out of their jobs. Obviously, a lot of militancy is going on in France. I think the fear here is that that kind of militancy is going to catch on here. There won't be students occupying. It will be a whole range of different kinds of people. If you've noticed any clever ideas apart from those attributed to Barbara Ehrenreich, they probably come from Noam Chomsky. My job in life is to go and present a watered-down, probably misunderstood version of Noam Chomsky's ideas to people apart from the world as my own. And I'll read something, which is probably the last thing I can say, in relation to this thing of conflict. Chomsky said in 1969 he was doing a talk at a college. They transcribed the talk and went down to publish it in book books. I don't think any of my thoughts are ever going to be issued that way. He said, in general, I think it's fair to expect that effective politics will lead to confrontation and attempts at repression. One has to be prepared to face this repression when it comes. But I think that one who takes his own rhetoric seriously will seek to delay the confrontation until he can have hope to emerge successful. I haven't changed the sex manager. This point indicates corollary to the remark that successful politics leads to confrontation, namely, that the search for confrontation indicates intellectual bankruptcy. It indicates the lack of effective politics which would, if carried out, lead very likely to confrontation. And that is something the consequences of which one once faced in the student movement. He's talking 4 years ago. It seems to me that the search for confrontation, aside from revealing a kind of intellectual bankruptcy, a failure to have found an effective politics, may also become a manipulative and coercive tactic. I think it often does. It becomes the kind of tactic which attempts to bring people to a certain degree of commitment, not by having it grow out of their own understanding and experience in the realities of the world, but as a result of a situation which often does not reflect the realities of society. That is manipulative and coercive, and I think also dangerous. I think it is the proper kind of tactic only for a movement of an elitist and authoritarian caste, whatever the people involved may feel about it. They may not be elitist and authoritarian, but means have a way of influencing consciousness. And I think that that's important enough to worry about, at least. So, co-editor of Peace News, I should point out that while Peace News is, in its origins and core, past this paper, I myself am more of a non-violent person rather than I wouldn't really hold to the absolute pacifist tag. And I will finish with a shameless plug at 2:41 for our Peace News on account, which you're all very welcome to come to for a long weekend, where we can continue discussing the things which we're going to discuss in the next 19 minutes. Thank you.